Nadia Mohajir is executive director of HEART, a national reproductive justice organization serving Muslim communities. Her commentary is headlined, "Muslims Have a Right to Contraception. Why Can Evangelical Bosses Take That Away?" And I am very pleased to welcome her to our show. Nadia, thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief.
Thank you so much for having me, Walton.
I think it's so important to make sure the language of religious liberty is not hijacked by the Christian political religious right. Talk about how you see the Supreme Court's Little Sisters decision as violating the liberty of the many millions of Americans who don't share the views of the plaintiffs in this case.
So, I mean, I think it's important to think about historically how the narrative around faith has been sort of constructed. And historically, if you look at, you know, how we talk about faith, we generally, and by we, I mean society, media, et cetera, you know, really generally talks about faith as being seen as a tool of oppression. And while those stories are absolutely there, we know that, you know, many faith traditions and have been misappropriated and been used in numerous ways to oppress people, especially women, and control decision making around their bodies. We also know that for many, there is the opposite narrative, right? That faith can actually be a tool of empowerment. It can be a framework for decision making. You know, no matter how simple or complex the decision may be, it can also offer people faith in a higher being and, like, you know, sort of a coping mechanism for the challenges that they may be experiencing. And it can also be just, you know, a belief system to live their lives by. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that story, the story of faith being a tool of empowerment, that's not told enough. And I believe, as a Muslim, I believe that that is what Islam is. Islam is, you know, very diverse in its thoughts around a lot of these issues, particularly pertaining to reproductive rights. And there, you know, it's not straight and narrow. There's no one way of being Muslim. There's actually a wide range of opinions, from very restrictive and, you know, for lack of a better term, conservative, to very, you know, permissive and you know, progressive in how it thinks about reproductive rights. And so I think that, you know, the Supreme Court decision is ignoring that, you know, many people actually have a faith that allows them to see their decision making as something that can be empowered through their faith lens.
You go beyond politics to highlight the real life impacts of this decision. Talk about those impacts, if you would.
This is not just about, you know, sitting in a boardroom trying to decide, you know, what's best for people. It's also about looking at the lived realities of people that will be impacted by this decision. And Muslims, just like any other group in this country, are impacted and face daily having to make decisions about their reproductive health, whether it's what contraception is right for me or whether it's about, you know, making the difficult decision of terminating a pregnancy. These are the lived realities of Muslims, just like they're the lived realities of Americans across this country. And mm-hmm. So I think that it's very important to think about how these decisions will impact the daily lives of all Americans, and not having access to contraception will not only limit just very literally their access to family planning decision making, but also, you know, we know that people use contraception for other reasons as well. And other times it's to control reproductive health conditions like PCOS, polycystic ovary syndrome, or endometriosis. It's also to control other health conditions. And so I think that that will also inevitably impact the people who are using contraception for those reasons as well.
I know this is not the only far-reaching initiative to disproportionately restrict the rights of minority groups. I think sometimes those effects are not even fully understood by the policymakers. What would it take for there to be a more fair and equitable process that considers this in a serious way?
What a great question. I mean, I think the first thing that comes to mind for that is literally representation, right? So I think it's important to name that the majority of folks that are making the decision in these boardrooms are elder, white, cis, heterosexual males who have not actually had to face a lot of the time the urgency or the difficulty of having to navigate these decisions, right? So that's the first thing. Even representation and having more women and people with vaginas be able to be in the decision-making room, so electing more judges that are impacted by these, electing more people of color that are impacted by these decisions, I think would be the first step. I think another way that we can bridge the gap between lawmakers and general population is by really thinking about what it would mean to have community-led conversations around these issues and, like, what would it look like for policymakers to engage in some really, really deep listening sessions to get a better understanding of why these issues are so important. And I know that a lot of times there are hearings where, you know, public is allowed to make testimony and things like that. But I think there's a disconnect happening there where it's still not enough. And I think part of that change will come from really internally making sure that the policymakers represent the communities that are going to be most impacted by this.
I hope I'm wrong, but I think there's a lot of ignorance among Americans regarding Muslim teachings on reproductive rights, and I wish you would explain what it is we should know about that.
I love that question, too. Thank you. And I totally agree with you. I think that there is a big misunderstanding of Islam as a faith and, you know, the fact that people are always share a lot of surprise when I share with them that Islam is actually very nuanced when it comes to complex issues like reproductive rights and justice, you know, and that's, you know, because a lot of that is a function of the media and the stereotypes that exist about Muslims, right? That Islam, there is only one way to practice Islam, that Islam is a monolith, and that the other, you know, big stereotype that's out there is that it's also an oppressive religion and that women don't have much say in their rights. And the fact of the matter is when you actually do dig into the historical texts and see what the scholars say about Islam, it's actually neither a monolith nor oppressive. You know, most of the time, as I mentioned before, you can find a diversity of thought when it comes to any number of these issues like contraception and family planning, abortion, taking care of your health, sexual pleasure for both men and women. So I think that, you know, a lot of times because the media has portrayed a specific story, right? This goes back to the narrative that we keep telling about communities of faith. And a lot of times the narratives that are uplifted about Muslim communities are narratives of, you know, women being oppressed and women being forced to practice a certain way. And while I don't want to minimize those stories, I mean, we have those stories in across all faith and cultural communities. I think it's important to uplift the fact that if that's all you see in the media or in the news, then that's what you're going to come to believe about the religion. And as a Muslim, I will tell you that those stories are not what is common in Islam. And we believe that Islam was actually revealed as a revolutionary and liberatory practice for women in particular. And if you look at the history of how women were given autonomy and freedom over their bodies and their decision making hundreds and hundreds of years ago, shortly after the prophet's passing, you'll see that a lot of these issues were not political. They weren't politicized, absolutely. And they also weren't issues that many men had to comment on. It was just something that women could just sort of take control of and do what was best for them in partnership with their midwives.
When government structures pander to the extra constitutional demands of powerful and well-organized groups, it's particularly impactful on marginalized and othered communities. Who gets hurt the most?
I mean, you just named it, right? Like, the communities who are living on the margins are the ones that get hurt the most, because oftentimes the way that we make policies and the way that we make decisions about any number of issues often centers the people who have the most power and the people who are in the majority, right? Even if workplace policies, government policies, however you want to think about making policies, you know, oftentimes the mistake that we make is we think about whose needs can we meet the most? And generally we think about meeting the needs of the people that are the most in number, when in reality, we should be thinking about meeting the needs of the minority or the people who are actually on the margins, because they are the ones who will generally have the most unique needs when it comes to their identities, when it comes to perhaps their privileges with respect to socioeconomic status, with respect to education, access to healthcare, access to providers, access to information. The other thing that we talk a lot about at Heart is how sex education for too long in this country has been taught sort of as a one-size-fits-all sort of approach, right? Using a one-size-fits-all approach, when in reality, our country and our youth is so diverse right now and their needs are so diverse that we no longer can afford to take a one-size-fits-all approach to even something like sex education, because yes, it's universal and there are some very specific needs that, you know, each community of color or each community of faith may have that will need some further context building and some further reflection opportunities and critical thinking opportunities to say, well, how does my cultural identity fit into what I'm learning? How does my faith identity fit into what I'm learning? And I think, you know, the only way to meet those needs is to be able to start thinking about how can we center the needs of those who are living on the margin. Mm-hmm. What do they need? And if we can meet those needs, then we will inevitably meet the needs of the majority.
Are there specific steps that people hearing our conversation should be taking to at least start to create momentum in the opposite direction in the name of true religious freedom for all?
That's a great question. I think one of the first things that comes to mind is exactly what you're doing here, is uplifting the voices of those communities, right? Uplifting the voices of people who represent those communities, not speaking for them, and giving them, not just passing them the mic, but giving them authentic leadership opportunities to be able to design solutions for their own communities. I think that that is something that's very important. I think another way to immediately shift the conversation is to start also supporting with your time and money the organizations that are leading this work. There are a lot of organizations that are popping up right now that are led by women of color, that are led by women of faith, who are at the forefront of this work. And often those are the organizations that are the most under-resourced and over capacity for the work that they're doing. And shifting the conversation can also look like shifting your support of who what your money is going to and what your time is going to.
Talking about organizations, Nadia, I want you to talk about Heart. What's the organization about? When did you start the work? And whatever else we need to know about it.
Yeah, thank you. So Heart is a national organization, and we are actually celebrating our 10th anniversary this year. So it's a very unique and special year for us. And also, really special because it's also a very critical election this year as well. And so we're very cognizant of how our 10th anniversary has fallen in the year of a very critical election. So we are a national organization that promotes sexual health literacy and sexual violence prevention in Muslim communities. And we do that through our four programming arms, which are our acronym, Health Education, Advocacy, Research, and Training. We generally work with Muslim communities, but all are welcome to our programming, of course. And we really just, you know, take folks to really understand their own lived experience with respect to sexual health and sexual violence, if they experience that, in a way that considers all of their identities. So, you know, in a way that considers their how their racial identity, how their cultural identity, how their faith identity, how their gender identity and their sexual orientation, all of those can impact and should impact the way that they are making their decisions about their bodies and how they can take more control and feel more agency over themselves and be able to also become a resource for their own communities. And a lot of the work that we do also looks at what our Muslim tradition says about a lot of these issues and tries to reclaim some of those values to be able to say that this work is not in conflict with being a Muslim or the faith identity. It's actually very much a part of being Muslim.
How can our listeners learn more about HEART?
They can visit www.hearttogrow.org. So www.hearttogrow.org. And they can also follow us on Instagram at hearttogrow or Facebook or Twitter. But our Instagram by far is really amazing in terms of the content that we offer. And so I would love for folks to follow us on Instagram, like us on Facebook, check out our website. We have a great resource library on our website where you can search by topic to see all the different publications and videos that we've produced on various issues that are impacting Muslim communities.
Nadia Mohajir is Executive Director of HEART, a national reproductive justice organization serving Muslim communities, and author of the commentary, Muslims Have a Right to Contraception. Why Can Evangelical Bosses Take That Away? I thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. It was wonderful.